Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Bald Move Prestige Films. We're talking about a great one today. The Sixth Sense, 1999's runaway blockbuster hit, cleaned up quite a few awards, if I recall correctly. Horror psychological thriller, written and directed by M. Night Shyamalan. It stars Bruce Willis, Toni Collette, Olivia Williams, Haley Joel Osment in his introductory role. Dude knocks out of the park. Scored by James Howard, which I thought was that score does everything it needs to. We're here to talk about it. It's been probably 5 or 6 years since I've seen this. I remember watching it one Halloween, I think just before we started doing the spooktacular, me and Cecily. So it's been a minute. But I've seen this movie quite a few times, 6, 7, 8. I really enjoyed my rewatch of it. What did you think, Jim?
Yeah, I'm the same. I've seen it a few times in the past, way back when it came out. I'd say maybe a couple of years after that, I saw it. And I really loved it. I thought, oh man, what a twist. And, that's the thing that everybody talks about with this movie. But yeah, sure. I was right along with him. Amazing twist. It just keeps you engaged the whole time. And coming back to it 20 plus years later, it held true. Everything that I loved about it the first time was still there. I went into it like knowing now, like every time I watch it, I get a more firm grasp on what they're doing here with the big twist. And obviously we're going to spoil the big twist here, right? There is no twist at this point. Everybody knows what happens. It's a meme. Mm-hmm. I watch it now to check out the little things that they do along the way and the points where I should have the first time gone, suspect. It holds up even on further watches.
Yeah, that's the thing that I was really looking for on this watch is like, what are the tells? Is everything internally consistent? Because when I watched this movie, I immediately watched it again and I wanted to see like, did this movie play everything kind of straight or did this movie do a usual suspects? And this like, well, I just have to throw out everything I knew about the movie before and watch it with fresh eyes. And I am always amazed at how like, pretty much face up this movie plays its cards and with a lot of skillful technique and some storytelling misdirection that he establishes just almost effortlessly in the first kind of 10 minutes of this film that carries so much weight that you just go right past flashing red, sometimes literally red things. drawing attention to things that you should know. I'm guessing that you did not know the twist the first time you saw this movie because I did not.
I didn't either.
I knew that there was a twist because, this film had had a certain a notoriety. And even then, like I was a much younger person, not as experienced in the ways of Hollywood, but still it just bowled me over. And I think that's the thing is like, I feel like 99 people walk into this theater out of 100 and they just completely bowled away. Like I'm sure there's a person that has put things together and, did notice things and all that kind of stuff, but it's really effective.
It is. Yeah. I'm surprised like the first subversion or the first time that you should be going, something is strange here is when they cut the camera away from him as he's laying on the bed with the gunshot in his belly. And you should be thinking, oh, man, what happened to him? Right. But then the camera comes back from a fade and we see him sitting on a bench across the street from this kid's house and he's watching him
researching his old from a gut shot, right?
Yeah, you can survive that totally. And you just kind of gloss over it. It's kind of amazing how easily he's able to get you onto the next part of this story without even thinking really about what you just saw. At least for me, that's how it worked. I got so wrapped up in what the story he was telling with this child and this psychologist who's haunted by this child that he failed. And it brings you in and engages you in the story in a way that makes you forget about the mystery that is that opening bit.
And so many things, like, because it feels like their natural progression of time. You expect him to, if he survives, to heal. You also, you saw their marriage on a certain trajectory, that the wife was feeling like, you know, that there's been a lot of sacrifices made in their relationship. And then at the pinnacle of success, when presumably maybe he could start to reinvest some of that time in the family, maybe start a family of their own. He gets shot by one of his failures. He's also kind of wallowing in this fraud imposter complex. So it's like when you see them, and also the movie is so brilliant in its almost dreamlike quality of time. Like the only time we actually have a time period passing that's drawn attention to us by the movie, it's very imprecise. Next fall.
Yeah.
Well, when did he get shot? Was it the winter? Was it the summer? Was it like, you know, like everything? And this movie reminds me of that line from Inception. Like when you're in a dream, you don't realize where you got there or why you're there. Like Bruce Willis just appears in scenes.
And he has to, because if you think about the logistics of being a ghost and getting into people's houses and sitting across from them for what, an hour while they just stare into the middle distance and you're speaking to them, like, none of that makes sense outside the context of the ghost sees what they want to see. None of that would make any sense. And so, you know, you can put a line in there that just kind of, blankets over that whole incongruity that you would feel if he didn't put it there.
Well, before we get to hardcore and spoilers, because I imagine maybe some people haven't seen this movie. This movie is now 22 years old. I imagine there's a lot of millennial Gen Z audience that's like, I've heard of the legend. But, you know, this movie is essentially like the Godfather to us if we were 20, you know, like in terms of how fucking old it is, you know, and how storied it is. If you haven't ever seen this before, please now stop. Yeah, watch it. It's great. I want to talk about, just in broad things, some M. Night Shyamalan things. I feel like, and we just watched Signs for our Science Fiction Sunday, so we're kind of on a little bit of an M. Night kick, you know? I feel like, especially in the first three movies of his, that he had, like, this germ of an idea that is something from, like, the pop culture consciousness. For example, this movie, the lens flares around ghosts and photography. You know, like that was like a big hobby industry, like in the early goings of the internet, like people just posting graveyard orbs and angelic lens flares and things like that. And he's like, oh, this is interesting. What if, you know, that's kind of like it's like his big thing is that what if true? Signs had the same thing with crop circles. You know, what if these things actually are pointing to some kind of extraterrestrial fucking around?
They don't do that much with it, though. Like, I'm surprised they've even left the lens stuff in there, the lens flare stuff, because I don't know. I get the impression that you don't really need that to believe that the mother would believe her son when he finally tells her what's up. But like, it seems like a little bit that they could have pulled out.
You are right. And just what kind of inspired Unbreakable is I think like soul survivor stories, right? It's not that it's like a huge part of the movie. It's more of like this was the acorn from which I'm trying to work backwards, because I actually wasn't able to find a lot in direct interviews where he, you know, talks about his inspiration. Actually, most of the stuff I've researched, there's like a dispute between I think him and Orson Scott Card about plagiarism, or maybe it was law. I can't remember who he got in like a plagiarism debate about. So it's like almost all the coverage about inspirations of The Sixth Sense goes back to that kind of like public spat. So I didn't actually have. So I was just trying to work backwards. Like, what was the thing? But he has these kind of like these inspirations, the things that set up like, you know, what if ghosts? What if they're trying to talk to people? You know, kids are kind of dicks. It's hard for your parents to take you seriously sometimes. And he turns these all into these very tight emotional situations. Like, and I guess that's the other thing is like, now that I'm a parent, the movie hits extra hard too, because like, it must really suck to have a troubled child and feel like you can't do anything. There's nothing that you can do to make them feel better.
There are two scenes that are really devastating emotionally, and one of them is that scene where they're sitting at the kitchen table and she's trying to get him to confess to moving her grandma, her mother's brooch or whatever it is into the drawer.
Yeah, bumblebee thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And he can't because he didn't move it. But like it, how can she believe him? Right. Because to believe him on that is almost to admit that like you're crazy or like he's crazy or the ghost exists, something like beyond reasonability. So you really feel for the mom in that situation. And she, yeah, I don't know, in that situation and in the car, when they are stopped at the accident, that's another scene where, holy shit, Toni Collette, great, great performance from her in this movie.
No, it's devastating. And they have these really cool, like this is a very small cast. You know, we talked about this, only essentially four principal actors and M. Night's floating around there too. but everything works in, and Donnie Wahlberg, everything works in his terms of like duo relationships. Like all revolves around Cole's relationship with his mother, Cole's relationship with Malcolm, Malcolm's relationship with his wife. I just think that like the way this thing, because like that's the thing, is like this on second, third and fourth watches. Yes, it's interesting to go back and see how tight the plot is and how the movie doesn't cheat and how like, oh, man, I can't believe I missed that. I can't believe I missed that. But like really this stuff, this the core of the engine of the movie where you have two people, you know, you got Haley Joel Osment as Cole and you got Bruce Willis as Malcolm. You know, Malcolm's at the top of his career in the first of the movie, and Haley Joel is presumably at the lowest point in his life. And throughout the movie, they like Haley Joel is kind of like this typical hero's journey. You know, he faces his fears. He comes out a more complete person. He integrates these things that always made him feel weird. And now he's accepted by his classmates and he's understood by his mother. And Bruce Willis is on a slide where he actually realizes that the relationship that he's in with his wife that he thought was deteriorating this whole time, he's mistaken. That relationship's just over. It's gone. Yeah. It's never coming back. It's about him coming to grips with something that he's already lost. And I feel like even though, you know, you can't really maybe get in the head of someone who's a ghost or who is seeing ghosts, like we can feel the idea of like not, you know, what am I trying to say? Not being delusional, but being in denial about something being over, or being feeling like you're persecuted or you're different or you're strange or you're weird or you're going through some kind of trauma that no one else can understand, and how isolating and lonely that can be.
And that's,
and those things are so universal. It makes it works even when the twist is old news.
For sure. And you mentioned like the relationship that the kids have in this movie and how it's depicted with, you know, the bullies and the freaks, right? This movie is all about having compassion for those people. You know, if not being able to understand what they're going through, at least understanding that they are going through something. And maybe not being dicks to them, maybe not judging them as harshly as we might want to. Yeah, I mean, it starts, you know, essentially on the very first note of this film with Donnie Wahlberg screaming about, yeah, you failed me, you know, all the way through to the end with Haley Joel Osment finally, you know, getting somebody to believe him, getting somebody to have some compassion for him and help him through this situation that finally resolves this whole thing. And showing compassion also to the ghost, right, who just need his help. That's all they're asking for. So it's really deeply embedded in this entire film.
The ghost thing is really interesting because we talked a little bit about this during the Signs movie, because I think Signs remain scary on multiple watches. But like I find The Sixth Sense is significantly less scary when you go through it multiple times, because you no longer see the ghost is trying to hurt him. The ghosts are just trying to be understood, and they're not, you know, they're maybe gory because the conditions of their death, but they're not intentionally trying to terrify or harass Haley Joel. All that stuff is just seems to be incidental to them trying to get his attention. And it's also interesting about the, like the compassion that you're talking about, because I compare this to, have you seen the movie Babadook?
I haven't. No.
They have a lot of similarities. And what's interesting is they both revolve around troubled children, but the Babadook is all from the POV of the mom. And I've noticed the audiences just fucking hate the little kid in Babadook. Everyone loves Haley Joel Osment because you see his point of view. But like, I challenge you to point to the difference between the kid in Babadook screaming and yelling and carrying on. And like Haley Joel, you know, when he's doing the Stanley stutter Stanley or whatever, he's being like a real fucking dick. And, you know, like, the kids are cruel, but you kind of can see it's like, it's pretty beyond the pale them locking him in the closet. But like, why kids would think this guy's just a weirdo, because he's always acting up in class when people trying to be nice to them. He's got this absurd reaction about being seen and all that kind of stuff. But it makes sense because you get his POV. Yeah. I just felt like it's really powerful to show like how much a person's POV can help you with that compassion and empathy.
For sure.
You know, And I think, you know, the mom here played by Toni Collette is almost like an infinite well of patience. She like loses her patience with him exactly once. But like most parents, you know, like a parent, you got an only kid and he's stealing shit from you. Like the instinct is to nail the kid and teach him the right from wrong and lying and not. And like, imagine how much trauma she'd inflict on him if she just like made him confess the things that he didn't do. Yeah. He's already... Like, there's so many heartbreaking details, like when Bruce Willis asked him about what he likes to draw and how he got in trouble for drawing, you know, people with nooses around their necks and with gunshot wounds. And he's like, I learned that you can't draw that, you know, just stick to puppies and horses and rainbows, because nobody gets called in the parent teacher conference for that. He's already shutting off so much of himself from his mother and everyone around them just so he doesn't become a burden. And I love that stuff.
And they also never make you, you talked about the POV coming from Cole in this movie. His mom never becomes a villain, right? Like, even though she does, you know, blow up at him once, you understand like how much patience she has, like you said. Every time she goes to that edge and she's about to, you think like in a horror movie, oh, the parent would be part of the problem, right? Here, she's very much trying to be part of the solution. And I think that really helps the story, because you feel like he's got an ally, but he's trying to protect her as much as she's trying to protect him. And because she doesn't have all the information, she just can't do anything for him. And even if she did have the information, like that's the catch 22 here, right? Like, he could tell her, how would you believe something like that? How could you? Right.
Yeah. And she's got this really, I think, a really great parenting technique about look at my face, you know, because she's clearly, even the time where she blows up and she goes off and she's clean and she's weeping because, you know, she's scared and she's afraid for her son. And when her son comes in and asks if he can sleep with her tonight, or is she too mad? She's like, look at my face. She uses this throughout the movie, and it's always like, you know, she's trying to reassure him that like, he's fine. She's not worried. But this time she's like, look at my face. I'm not angry. I'm just sad and I'm worried
and confused and scared. And yeah,
I thought it's actually a really good parenting technique for what the, but you're right. You never feel like she is the problem, or she is made to be a villain, which is pretty amazing for a 22-year-old horror movie, that often makes, you know, like kids in horror movies are only designed to make you feel sympathy. You threaten them so that you feel extra. Here, like, it's a fully realized character. And I guess maybe it's appropriate to talk about like what a singular performance this Haley Joel Osment was able to deliver here. I mean, how fucking good he is as a 9-year-old in this movie.
Sure.
Carrying really complicated scenes. Like, Bruce Willis is an excellent scene partner. Toni Collette, turns out, I don't think she was known for much at the time. I could be wrong here, but she's a really good scene partner too, and is a little bit of a horror scream queen in the making in this movie. But he, you know, that scene that he does, and where he's like the gives away the whole movie, the I see dead people, they don't know they're dead. That's really hard to do. That like that breathy thing he's doing could come across so like annoying or intentionally or affected, but he just comes across as a kid that's barely afraid to raise his voice because he doesn't want to draw any attention to himself, because every attention in this world seems bad to him.
Yeah, it's constant. I was bracing myself when that line was about to come up, and I knew it when the camera, you know, zooms in on him. I'm like, oh boy, is this going to be as good as I remember it? It absolutely was. He nails it. Yeah, I expected something cheesier in the delivery. I expected a hint of like, oh, eye roll. It wasn't there. It wasn't there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no meme. I mean, it is definitely a meme, but it's like in that scene, it's not. And I think that I was reading a little bit, and the cinematographer and M. Night were discussing whether they should trim the scene or keep it tight on Haley Joel's face, because they thought that that push in shot on Bruce Willis' face when he says, "I see dead people, they don't know they're dead," that it was going to give the movie away. Mm-hmm. But like, he's like, they're like, you know, they watched several test audiences and no one reacted in the way they thought. People thought, you know, that there'd be a whole bunch of big, "I bet Bruce Willis is the dead guy." But he's like, it's not. And I wonder, is it like that Haley Joel Osment is like such a mirage that people like you, because at this point, you could certainly have all the tools to put together the piece of puzzle, and the slow push in on Bruce's face feels like, if you're in the know, this is obvious.
Yeah.
But also, it's just a really great shot of an adult reacting to something fucking bizarre and weird and also very real, because this kid is clearly tormented by it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying, like, to me, it's like it's not like him suppressing a realization about himself. It's more of him trying to keep that clinical mask of like, he's like, oh, this kid's super, you know, disturbed. Like, he's like full on hallucinating things. And also, you know, this is so much like the patient I had before and the scary situations I had with them. It doesn't come across as a tell at all. You just get lost in the performance.
Especially, and Shyamalan does this with, you know, scene after scene, when you combine it with what comes after it, where he's like, oh, I can't help this kid. Then retroactively, your brain says, oh, that zoom in is all about his realization that this kid, like you said, is far more disturbed than he knows how to counsel away. Right. We won't be able to help him. And Haley Joel is so good throughout this movie. And it doesn't have like a huge range that he has to try and do, because most of the time he's this scared boy who is just trying to get by every single day. And he's, you know, running from shadows and kind of like shrinking away from stuff. But then there are moments where, and one of my favorite ones in this movie is when he tells Bruce Willis what, you know, what his problem is. "I see dead people." Bruce Willis goes, "Oh boy, I can't help you." And they're not going to see each other anymore. And then he comes back and he finds Haley Joel in the church, and Haley Joel has this attitude about like, "Oh yeah, no, now you get it, right? Like, oh, you're mm-hmm. you're back, huh? Uh-huh, sure." Mm-hmm. He's got this hilarious affect to him. And then at the end, when he has sort of integrated his affliction, let's say, into his life a little bit more and understood these ghosts, he's you know, he's flipped a switch there where he can be kind of a more happier, lighter presence on screen. And I think he nails all of it.
Even there's some early good work where him and his mom are like trading what their fantasy life, you know, like she says that I went and had this picnic in the park and I swam, and like, he just kind of lights up and like, you know, and he's also like, I don't know why they went away with this, but the first time we see him, he's wearing these enormous Coke bottle glasses, which makes me think of like the, what was that? The Jonathan Lipnicki from what's that Tom Cruise movie where "Show Me the Money, You Had Me at Hello"? Jerry Maguire.
Yes.
Like, I like, they seem like they were really leaning into that or the Harry Potter look, and he's just in that one scene, and I'm like, man, I don't remember him wearing these big glasses, but he's fucking adorable. I guess they decided he didn't need the crutch or it was going to interfere with his performance later on. But he's just really good. Now, let it be said, I actually think M. Night is very good with children. Like, those first three movies, Haley Joel Osment knocks it out of the park. Good for him. The second kid that's Bruce Willis's son in Unbreakable is really makes the rest of the performance work. And he's very, very good. I thought both of the kids in Signs that we saw last night were very good in kind of like weirdo roles that could traditionally seen as off-putting. I think it must be hard to direct kids because like they don't have like, thank God, or, you know, usually they don't have the like vast experience of the human condition to call upon, you know, yeah. like what it looks like to do be a panic attack. What does it look like, you know, to be insanely angry? What's it look like? But he's got in mind what he wants this child to do and is somehow able to explain, because I think it's, yeah, obviously Haley Joel is very talented. But when you see so many child actors that are so good, and that's what ultimately, and maybe we can talk about this towards the end, but like so frustrating about Avatar: The Last Airbender, because he gets nothing from those kids. Yeah. He gets nothing at all from them. In roles where they're meant to be charismatic.
Yeah, it might be easier to work across from Bruce Willis than it is across from a green screen. That's the only thing I can imagine.
Possibly. Maybe it's just anytime he gets out of setting something in Philadelphia, it just all goes.
Yeah.
It all goes pear shaped for him. Yeah.
All right. Before we move on here, let's take a break.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
I wanted to talk about some of the other things that were certainly intriguing when I saw this movie the first time. I was probably 18, maybe 19. I don't know. I was young when I saw this the first time. And so there were a lot of concepts mm-hmm. in here that were just interesting to me because they were new and they seemed completely novel. And one of those is, I think it's called Munchausen by proxy. It's yeah. The poisoning of this child by her mother that led to her death eventually, and how she had then started doing that to the younger daughter. And over the course of this wake or whatever it is, the you know, ghost helps Haley Joel Osment expose this, and he brings the box in and it shows the father, and she's presumably arrested and charged and whatever.
Yeah.
That was such, I had never conceived of that concept. And maybe this, you know, says something about my childhood where I had parents who did not try to murder me. So that was pretty nice. But I just hadn't thought the like, oh, this is a thing that happens. And I certainly didn't know the term for it. And so when I saw this, I was just kind of blown away by how dark and disturbing that was. And that's not the only occasion, but that's like the big one.
Yeah, it's a lot of like the sharp object stuff. And also like when I paid a little bit more attention to this too, because they make a big deal about how far away this ghost was. Like most of the people that Haley Joel interfaces with are people that, like, you know, he's walking through a school on the grounds where people were hung, or the school burnt down. There's a lady burnt, or there's a person, you know, in this wreck here. Like it's all kind of very localized. But this ghost is traveled a long distance to get to Haley Joel because she is trying to protect her little sister, you know. And there's that really great scene where Haley Joel is talking to the littler sister and talking about how much her sister loved her. And it, you know, it's like they don't really connect the dots. This is something I notice on multiple watches, is like that just. Yeah, and that's why this movie is so much fun to rewatch, is there's so much depth. There's mm-hmm. so many of these throwaway lines that, like, when you're watching it and things connect, it's so much more of a deeper experience.
Yeah.
Did you know that the puke girl, the Munchausen by proxy victim, is Misha Barton?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if I've really seen her in much of anything else.
I know she was like blew up as a hot girl. She was in the OC, which I never watched in a couple movies. But like I noticed that in the casting. I just want to point it out. But
yeah, I'm sure there are big Misha Barton fans out there. I'm not one of them. She's fine, and she's good in this.
There's also other,
yeah.
Oh, I was gonna say, just like the other thing is, there's a whole bunch of rules that they built up around the ghost. The ghost can't really manipulate physical matter unless they're in a very extreme emotional state. The fact that like this girl traveled that distance across town was able to rip open Haley Joel's ghost tent that no other ghost had able to do. It's like there's all these things that kind of like stacked up to show like just what a ball of fire this little ghost girl was about saving her littler kid sister, which I thought was touching on this time.
You hinted at something early on in this podcast about Red. Sometimes you said something about there sometimes being literally red flashing lights.
Yeah.
And this, you know, Misha Barton with the ghost tent stuff brings me to it because that tent is red. And so if you look at this movie, and this is something I noticed I think for the first time during this watch. And then I went back afterward and I saw, oh, yeah, no, this is a thing people are talking about. And it's very much intentional. But if you look at some of the scenes where there's a ghostly presence or where there's a very strong emotion around a ghost presence, there are a lot of things in those scenes that are red, and they use red to sort of signify that. So the biggest one, the one where I started noticing it, was at the birthday party, I think, the bully's birthday party. He's wearing a red sweater. That balloon that flies up to the stairwell ceiling is red. I think there's one other red thing in that scene, but I definitely was like, oh, okay, I'm connecting the dots. And then the one that surprised me that I was like, aha, I see what you did there, is when Bruce Willis is listening to the tape recorder and look at the volume knob, all the numerals are painted red.
Yeah, well, no, they go from like as he turns it up, they're white. But when he gets to like presumably the unsafe range, which coincidentally is where he starts hearing the ghosts, they turn like I think they go like there's one that's orange and then they go red.
Nice.
And I was that's one of the things I was wanting to do because I knew about this and I was wanting to write down all the red things. And when I got to that, because I noticed most of them the first couple of times, like the handle, all this stuff.
I noticed a couple new ones.
Like Toni Collette, when she's going over all those pictures of Haley Joel Osment seeing the lens flares, all her nails are painted like a fire engine red.
Huh, okay.
You know, the handle on the door. But like that one really blew me away that like the volume turns red when he gets to the ghost volume. I'm like, God damn, that's really fucking slick. And M. Night, he said in the interview that they're like the red is supposed to like designate physical objects or characters that are at the transition between life and death. And there's a couple the mother of the puke girl, Misha Barton, she's covered. She's wearing a red sweater and she's surrounded by red roses, you know, because she's like literally surrounded by death. She's kind of like this stepmother of death. But yeah, I there's so many of those, like Bruce Willis's wife wrapped up in a red blanket when she's shivering in the cold at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
It's all really strong.
So
yeah.
I didn't get okay. The doorknob is an obvious like flashing red light here. It's amazing to me how well they camouflage that within the movie, though, because there are several insert shots that are close ups of Bruce Willis grabbing the handle, yanking on that door, it making a racket and not opening. And they do it multiple times in this movie. And every time I'm like, what the hell is that all about? And then they cut to something else. And I get so engrossed in the next scene that I totally forget that I should be focused in on that doorknob. It's kind of remarkable how easily they trick me into not thinking about it for the next 15 minutes.
Yeah. And like, cause they, when you're talking about those inserts, I was paying a lot of attention to those because he like, when he like pulls them, like, you know, rattles and like, I can't write. And then he puts his hand in his pocket
looking for a key,
but then they cut away. And then and presumably he's down in the basement. And so he gets in there somehow. And I like, what I don't know is whether he just apparates down there and like, he's just haunting his basement. But I've got this theory that like, yeah, the wife notices there's all these weird shit happening around and she progressively like, okay, the door keeps opening and shutting. So she locks it. Then the door gets unlocked. So like finally she barricades it with like this table. Yeah. And like he just because like she's, you know, when you look at this from her perspective, she's also dealing with a whole bunch of spooky supernatural shit. And, you know, they also there's a hint or two. So let's talk about like the camouflage that because like I said, he lays all these cards face up on the table, but he does camouflage them a little bit.
Yeah.
I noticed that in the very first scene where Bruce and his wife are talking about his award, she puts on a shawl and she kind of shivers. And I'm like, oh, interesting. They kind of put this as a character trait of hers because, you know, she's kind of shivery. And so that way, when you notice her shivering throughout the movie, you're not going to think, oh, Bruce Willis ghost. But she's probably shivering because this Mark Wahlberg has brought, not Mark, Dan, this was Danny Wahl. This is, wait.
Donnie.
The guy from Saw. The OG Wahlberg. He's probably bringing his whole fucking menagerie in with him. And that's why she's shivering because she feels his presence. Almost to the extent that, like, maybe she has got a little bit of sensitivity to ghosts as well.
Maybe. I hadn't considered that. I know that they do other things too, like they leave windows open near her occasionally so that you could conceivably think, oh, well, there's a draft coming in and she would be cold. Maybe, you know, it's autumn in Philadelphia. It's going to be chilly. Yeah. They do a lot of really good camouflaging in this.
And the best one is the trajectory he puts Bruce Willis as he gets gunshot is a project like a plausible trajectory that his marriage would be falling apart.
Yeah, and, like, and then he would become obsessed and pour himself even further into this
into
this
the next case because he has to feel like, you know, this kid killed himself. And
that's true.
And it's killed just, him too.
He does it from the other side of existence, right? He's like,
yeah, and like you just don't notice like when he goes for the first the anniversary, you know, and he sits down at a table like he's running late and she's finishing her dessert and she's not making eye contact with him. You can read that as her just being furious that once again he's put like after he almost got killed through because of his work that he's throwing himself into work and ignoring an important occasion again. And, you know, he's kind of poor and he's like, hey, I'm sorry, blah, blah, blah. And she just kind of like as he goes to reach for the check, she grabs it from him and says, happy anniversary. And it feels like really fucking cool. But she in reality, she's just hung up on him. And also they strongly imply that like he is the one that's keeping her hung up, like his continuing to be around her is what's kind of tethering her because she's trying to, you know, and you see like I love the scene where the young guy first calls on her and he's like, keep moving, cheese dick, because he thinks this guy is like moving in for an affair. But it's her trying to take steps to like move on a relationship. And then when he catches him, was it hugging or kissing, and he shatters the window, you know, it just again, it just feels naturally like this guy is again seeing a disintegrating relationship. He probably should invest more time in it, but he can't because he's got to save this kid, and that's noble. And then the ultimate tragedy is it's already too late. Nothing he can do can change the disillusion of the marriage. It's already gone. He's dead.
Yeah. And I like, you know, we talked briefly about the doorknob and I didn't read that as like, oh, she's experiencing spooky things happening. I read that more as she is trying to close off that part of her life. Cause honestly, like when I was watching this movie, I didn't realize that was even the basement door. I had no idea what this door was. Cause it's like under the stairs. I thought it was just some kind of storage he's trying to get into, whatever.
Harry Potter.
But yeah, I guess like, and there's that very first shot right in the movie where the light bulb comes on. And she is down in the basement getting a bottle of wine to celebrate. And there's something uneasy about that whole space for her. And so when she later, you know, at the end of the movie, it's revealed she's blocked it off with this table. You can kind of understand that, OK, this has now a double meaning for her. Right. This is for some reason. I don't know why Bruce Willis in this big fancy brownstone or whatever in the middle of Philadelphia is working in the basement. I don't know if that was his office before this, before he died.
I think so. Yeah. That's his little child psychologist cave.
That's wild, man. He's probably got at least 3 bedrooms in that thing, right? Use one of those.
Maybe, yeah. And
that was just wild to me. But I like that, like, she would block it off emotionally and physically because she's trying to get by having lost him.
One of the things I wondered about this movie, this again is a 7th or 8th time through it, is at what point does Cole, which his last name Sear, which I thought was interesting because it's like, you know, it's a fairly common last name, but also it's Sear, you know, at what point does he become aware that Bruce Willis is a ghost? Does he know right away?
Immediately, I think. Yeah.
You think so? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, there's definitely a point in the movie where he comes to the conclusion. And I think when he says, I'm ready to tell you my secret, I think I always thought that's when he figured it out. Because Bruce Willis doesn't look like a dead guy. And the only way you can see that he's dead is if he's not wearing a sweater and not wearing his coat, because his exit, the entry wound is like covered by his belt and is small and not bloody.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Cause I think that is kind of interesting.
I took him running from Bruce Willis as being acknowledgement that a ghost is chasing him and that he wants to get out of there. And that happens immediately.
When does that happen?
It's the very first thing after Bruce Willis gets shot. It fades to black. It comes back up. He's sitting across the street watching Haley Joel come out of his house and onto the street. And then he chases him down the street because Cole just takes off running.
Does he? I thought that Cole just took off running because that's what he does. He dashes from place. But I didn't know that there was an interaction where he was actually chasing him. Interesting.
There isn't. That's the thing. I'm not sure if Cole is aware.
I thought he was just doing
like
recon on this kid that he, you know, like this is just his deal. He goes with a notebook and he's kind of tries to see how he interacts with his peers and his parents with surreptitiously and.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the other thing. The first time where he sits there and he's sitting there with his mom, like, you should know, like, that is like, well, because she doesn't acknowledge him at all. And she goes over there and starts with this like, oh, I had this perfect day. But then she gets up and says, you've got an hour, which is the standard time a therapeutic thing lasts. And like, you can kind of like, also, it's probably how long it takes her to make dinner. It does throw you off. Like, you got this idea that like the mom and Bruce have this long heart to heart and that he's home and it's time for, you know, him to clock in and work with him. It's real strong.
So I mean, that whole scene is brilliant, man. Like the conceit here of this game, right? So there are a couple things that they do, like the magic trick, the game that they play here with one step forward, one step back, that kind of thing. That is a writer kind of at the peak of their game, a screenwriter, because they are visually integrating. Shyamalan here is visually integrating the storytelling mm-hmm. with what's happening on the screen. And it mm-hmm. is, it's so good. And when you see Bruce Willis, like, think he's got this kid's number, right? I've seen these cases so many times. Yeah, this is just one of those. Daddy left you and you're holding on to his things because you miss him. He's right to a degree, right? And he gets a few steps forward, but then when he starts stepping back, things get dark and you're like, oh,
mm-hmm.
oh no, this is far more serious, far more complex than he thought at first. It's just a great way to tell that story.
And Bruce Willis we've remarked on this many occasions, on screen, he has an immense amount of charm that works on both men, women, and children. But in M. Night's films, like, he's turned to like the lowest setting of dim of his personal light bulb, like in both Unbreakable and The Sixth Sense. He's just barely speaking above a whisper, like all the colors drain. He's at an emotion. He's at a very low point in his life. And the only point in this movie, really the only point he comes alive is when he's pissed off at his wife's lover. And when he's interacting with, you know, he turns on his Bruce Willis charisma with, like you said, the magic trick and I can read your mind. And it's really cute. And it works because we know this is Bruce Willis in a hairpiece, and he's turning on his charm for this kid. He doesn't feel something he doesn't feel. And it just works so well. I really like the arc of, again, you know, him achieving the pinnacle of success and feeling like he is still a failure. And then one of his failures actually comes and kills him. Oh, by the way, Donnie Wahlberg, I guess M. Night asked him to lose a little bit of weight to give him a kind of a gaunt, and he thought he'd lose like 5 or 10 pounds. This guy rolled in 46 pounds lighter, and you can like he's almost unrecognizable.
Yeah, I was shocked when I saw him in the credits. So I'm like, Donnie, what? No, that can't be him.
Yeah, he's so fucking tormented and tortured. But it sets up this, like, again, the dual structure of him being at a high point and descending into loss. And essentially his arc is accepting oblivion, you know,
yeah,
letting his wife move on with her life and letting him move on with his unlife. At the same time, Haley Joel's arc rises. I thought that there's that middle point where he says, I see dead people. I thought there's something structural there, but that's when he realizes that he's dead. And there's almost a switch between therapist and patient, because in the end, yeah, he's the one giving him advice, like, hey, if you know, let me I think I have a way for you, your wife, to hear you. Make sure you talk to her when she's asleep. And, you know, because he's the ghost whisperer. He knows these things. I still remember this like it was yesterday when that, you know, they build up this point, and when that, you know, he's given this speech about, like, hey, he's all this distant, and her, she's starting to shiver. And then when the ring hits the ground and rolls out, it's such a great moment. And then there's another piece of camouflage that M. Night used, because I guess Bruce Willis is a lefty, and they realize early on in the script that he's going to have to write. And if he writes with his left hand, you'll see that the wedding ring isn't there. And that's something. So he taught himself how to write right handed just enough to take notes and whatnot, so that he wouldn't spoil the wedding ring.
That explains the note written in red that we see, like scribbled in red. Bruce Willis must have wrote that on set, right? As practice.
yeah.
Cause,
well, he's playing awful. A doctor, so that's always a nightmare. And then, sure, you know, he's also writing, he's a southpaw writing righty.
I want to talk more about the structure of this movie, but let's take a quick break and then we'll come back.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's talk a little more in depth about the structure of this movie, because it's not very conventional. This is a strange movie in its structure, because if you look at this movie, a lot of it, the first half of it, maybe there's really only the barest hint of any kind of ghost story, any kind of horror whatsoever.
Yeah,
it's structured similarly to like an Unbreakable. Shyamalan's got some things that he likes to do, right? He likes these home invasion stories, where somebody breaks in and disrupts the cozy family life you have, and that's the catalyst for the rest of the film. They do that here, but the first half of this movie, right up until Cole's secret is revealed and he says, I see dead people, the first half of this isn't really much of a ghost story. There's a couple of scenes, one really notable scene where the mom, where Toni Collette is, you know, trying to clean the stain off his tie, puts it in the laundry room, comes back to the kitchen 4 seconds later, and all of the pantry doors are open, all of the drawers, everything. It's a freaky scene, but you're not sure what's going on there, right?
Right.
And up until I See Dead People, we don't actually see any ghosts in this movie. And it's really, yeah, it's really interesting, because then it turns into almost full-on horror. And then by the end, yeah, of it, it's like no longer a horror movie, right? There are like three pieces to this movie that all work together so well, because even in that first, yeah, half, I'm not thinking, man, when are they going to get to the horror? I'm thinking, this is a super interesting story. These characters are great. I want to see what happens.
Yeah. And like I said, even without the supernatural element, the relationships within the characters and their arcs kind of work. I mean, I guess Bruce Willis has to be a ghost or his arc doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
like all the other stuff, like it's, yeah, the paranormal stuff and even the twist. Like, that's the thing. Like, this is, there's a few things that if you, it's just a twist. And once you get that, like the rest of the movie's not as entertaining to watch. But what I think makes M. Night at his best and guys like Christopher Nolan is they make these twisty movies and they're almost always enjoyable on multiple because they're always well grounded emotionally. Like, mm-hmm, it's not just you're scared and it's a thrill ride thing. It's also just a really, at the heart, it's a really good movie. And in the same way that, like, I remember we did the podcast for The Exorcist. Like, I was expecting that to be a world class horror film. I was not expecting it to be like just a really good piece of filmmaking on top of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we talked a little bit about this on last night's live stream. But, you know, when I was growing up, horror was kind of at a low point. It was like the best of times is the worst of times. Right. Because there's, mm-hmm, so much horror being made. There's all this schlocky, just gallons of Karo syrup with red food, you know, and guys in hockey masks and guys in razor blade gloves. And there wasn't like dread and real, yeah, horror. It was slasher shit, right? But like this movie, is really, and also like it got nominated for a bunch of awards. I'm not sure how many it actually won.
Yeah, let's talk about that. It didn't win any awards, which kind of shocked me.
Really?
This was a weird year. So the 72nd Academy Awards in 2000, kind of dominated by American Beauty. Sam Mendes won Best Director. It won Best Picture. Kevin Spacey won Best Actor for all for that movie. Best Screenplay, American Beauty. So it kind of soaked up all the awards, but Sixth Sense was nominated for 6 awards. It was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, Supporting Actor, Supporting Actress, and Film Editing. It lost 3 of those to American Beauty, 4 of those to American Beauty. No, 3. Supporting
was
Actor.
It for Bruce Willis the supporting, and then Toni Collette for Supporting Actress?
Yeah, Haley Joel for, the supporting actor, and Toni Collette for actress.
Oh, Haley Joel. So Bruce Willis didn't get recognized at all. I guess he'd be the lead, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he was not even nominated. Angelina Jolie won that for Girl Interrupted, which I haven't seen, though I hear it's spoken fondly of.
I haven't either. Yeah, yeah.
And Michael Caine won for Cider House Rules.
Another one I haven't seen.
And film
but
editing.
It's Michael Caine, so...
Here's the other remarkable thing. 1999, I mean, to me, stands out because of The Matrix.
Right.
And The Matrix is damn near absent from a lot of these categories. Like, I'm shocked. So it won Best Film Editing. It won, you know, Best Visual Effects, stuff like that. But there are things like Best Cinematography that probably should rightly go to The Matrix for having invented a camera technique that will just be used in everything for the next 25 years, right?
Right.
Completely unrecognized in cinematography. It wasn't even nominated in cinematography.
That sucks.
American Beauty ended up winning Best Cinematography, which strange to me. Best Art Direction was Sleepy Hollow. Like,
why?
Really?
Yeah,
really?
Tim Burton getting the... Yeah, wow. Well, you know, sometimes the Oscars, they don't look so well in hindsight. But,
yeah. I guess you can't blame them for not seeing the trend that would be The Matrix filming techniques.
Well, what blew me away, because after I get done with my one of the last things I do after I get all my research done is I like to read Roger Ebert's review. And I always feel gratified when he points out stuff that I point out. And I always feel kind of chagrined when he hits on things that I missed. But. Give this movie 3 stars. Now, if you know Roger's personal metric, he grades things like by genre, like, you know, 4 star. Like if he gives True Lies 4 stars, that doesn't mean it's as good as The Godfather. It just means, hey,
right.
Of action popcorn flicks, this is about the best example that you can make of one. What's a better psychological horror film than The Sixth Sense? I'm not saying it's the best of all time. But it's up there, like across all genres, across all generations. Like, what is what's the 4-star one that it? So, like, maybe there was a little bit of sleeping on it. Here's the other thing. When I think about M. Night Shyamalan's style, he's not real flashy. It's not that he doesn't like what I know. His scripts are tight. At least his initial ones. Everything is very well emotionally grounded, and it works in a suspense, like in a Hitchcockian way. It's like unparalleled. Some of the things he does to increase tension in this and Signs and in Unbreakable are incredible, but he doesn't have like a signature, you know, everything's very restrained. The camera doesn't move frantically. There's a few kind of nice like sky shots. Like some of the staging was good, like, you know, Bruce Willis standing in the central area of the church, and then Haley Joel's kind of stalking around in the balcony, literally having kind of the moral high ground in the conversation. Some of that stuff is good. There's that great spiral shot. A shot of the spiral staircase with the balloon going up, and then the kids looking up at Haley through that. Some of that stuff is good, but it's not really flashy. Maybe it's so buttoned down and restrained and emotionally muted that it just didn't register as the like giga hit it is now. Because 22 years later, this is a classic.
Oh yeah,
you know,
yeah, for good reason. And there are, you know, occasional flourishes, like you mentioned, the stairwell scene. But there's one shot I noticed after having watched this yesterday and then going directly into Signs. I noticed a couple of similarities between like things that he does consistently in his movies and maybe just these early ones. But these two both have shots of specifically reflections of the main characters in awards that they've won, like. Yeah, they shoot like the 507 footer plaque reflecting Mel Gibson or whoever, or maybe
Joaquin Phoenix and Signs.
At the beginning of this movie, they shoot Bruce Willis and his wife. I don't remember her name. I've seen her in a couple other things like Rushmore.
Olivia Williams. Yeah, the only thing I've ever seen her in is Rushmore. That's it.
But they shoot them reflected in his plaque for. His prestigious plaque for
child trauma healing
psychology, whatever he won. So he loves to do that. Like I said, he loves the home invasion. He kind of loves people driving and then falling asleep while driving, because in Signs that's a whole plot point. In this, Bruce Willis tells a story. He tries to tell this, like, read a bedtime story or make up a bedtime story for this kid, Haley Joel Osment. And he's like talking about this guy who's driving, he falls asleep. And then he wakes up and he's driving, which sort of feels like the beginning of this movie as well. Like, you know, he's diagnosing, he gets shot, he falls asleep, he wakes up, he's still diagnosing. It feels like there's something he's trying to do with that story in here, but he uses the same type of story in this movie as well.
Yeah, honestly, car wrecks and vehicular wrecks in general are a big part of his movie, because, yeah, Unbreakable, it's all about the train wreck. There's the car wreck in Signs. There's the car crash at the end of this movie that brings Haley Joel and his mom together over the grandma. Like, yeah, he definitely. And also the weird hatches underneath the staircase was featured in Signs and this movie. I'm not sure if there's one in Unbreakable, but yeah, he does have his little, I guess, signature marks. Sure. I want to talk about a couple questions. Will something like The Sixth Sense ever happen again? Because The Sixth Sense was largely pre-internet. I mean, I know it was like the dial-up era there was, but like the Twitter didn't exist. Facebook didn't exist. Reddit didn't exist. I don't know that a movie with this kind of twist could stay hidden under the current environment. Like, if you don't see something on opening weekend, you're probably going to hit it, like, no matter how hard you try, unless you stay off of all of the internet, which is almost impossible for most people. Do you think that we'll ever have an event like this where, like, you know, oh, have you seen The Sixth Sense? Oh, I can't. Oh, wait till you do. It's amazing. Like, without people just like being jerks and spoiling it. I don't know that there is something like I mean, Inception kind of was that way.
Okay.
It feels like it's harder. I still don't understand Tenet. So that's one way to hide a twist. Is you just like, where was the twist? Was that the midpoint of the movie? The end? Is supposed to watch this thing backwards?
No, that's a good question. I think it's certainly harder to do nowadays. It's funny, this movie came out at the same time as Blair Witch Project, and Blair Witch Project had like this marketing campaign which probably couldn't exist on the internet today.
Oh shit, 99 was the year of the twists, because The Matrix, like, its trailer was essentially, what is The Matrix?
Right.
What is, go to whatisthematrix.com, speaking of the internet, because, like, what the fuck is, like, I walked into The Matrix not really knowing. I knew it was going to be mind-blowing and jaw-dropping, but I didn't know how this shit fit together and what the story was going to be.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, 99 had a lot of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's possible. It's certainly harder. I know that much.
Let's talk about M. Night Shyamalan's career and like what the fuck happened to this guy. So he starts off in 1998 making this movie called Wide Awake, which I've never seen. It's largely panned, 42% on Rotten Tomatoes, made no money. Then the next year he sells a script for $3 million on spec.
This movie,
because the script is a banger. It's The Sixth Sense.
I read that obviously the guy who optioned this movie got fired very soon after.
Right, because he didn't get permission. He just like, yeah, fuck yeah, I'll buy this $3 million script. You see how hot this script is? And given,
I hope
and
they also hired his ass back after the box office numbers on this thing.
So M. Night is interesting because like a lot of it's a fun little game to anytime you see like a first time anybody to go on their Wikipedia article and look at their parents and see if they have Wikipedia articles. Now, M. Night is a son of immigrants from India, first generation. So that's kind of like a disadvantage. But his parents also were both physicians, clearly very wealthy. But like the chutzpah of this guy coming off of a bomb. I got this script. It's $3 million if you want it. Oh, by the way, if you option it, I have to be the director.
Yeah.
Like, what?
I don't know how it ever got bought.
How did this happen? Yeah, and it actually got the guy. I wonder if this guy like got any kind of revenge because, like, you know, you get this movie and it's universally acclaimed. It gets nominated for all these awards and it makes like what, 30 times its budget?
Dude.
Is the darling of the like does he get rehired? Does he get like
he should?
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
It's debatable. Like, yeah, he picked a massive success, but he also did it just unilaterally. I don't know. Subverting the process is probably an offense in itself. But yeah, it made cost $40 million to make. It made like $630 million in the box office.
So crazy return.
Massive success. No, it was actually the second movie to do, I want to say 10 weeks in a row, 8 weeks in a row at number one in the box office.
Number one.
Only after Titanic. This was the second movie to do it, which is kind of shocking.
Oh, the word of mouth on this movie was insane because everybody's like, you got to see this movie. It's like one of the best movies I've ever seen and it's shocking and all this stuff.
Mind blowing. Yeah.
So he follows this up a year later, runs Bruce Willie back to the box office with Unbreakable, my favorite of his films. I love this movie. Then he comes back 2 years later with Signs, another one that I love, another kind of more traditional, I guess, horror movie. Unbreakable is kind of like a swerve away from that, with a twist, although it's hard to really put your finger on what the twist is in Signs. Then he has The Village, another psychological quasi supernatural thriller with a twist. It's starting to like, this is where you start getting into the below 50% Rotten Tomatoes. I still really like The Village. I thought The Village was great. A great performance by Joaquin Phoenix and Bryce Dallas Howard, rather. Then you get Lady in the Water. And that's where, like, I still like Lady in the Water. But for a lot of people, the wheels really fucking came off there. Paul Giamatti running some kind of motel that's visited by some water sprite that's chased by some wolfoid bullshit. Like, I think it's great. As a like a modern day fairy tale, like a Grimm brother fairy tale, but a lot of people don't like it. Then The Happening. Everybody hates The Happening, even though the first third of that movie, I think, works really well as a horror film. It's just the twist is so fucking stupid. And Donnie Wahlberg is so miscast, like as this brilliant geneticist. It just doesn't fucking work. And then the last Airbender comes and just destroys his career. He got like something like $200 million to make this movie. It barely made 300 globally. Yeah, it was going to be this fat franchise that's super popular and he just destroys it with one film. And it took him a long time to where he could get, you know, something going again. I know he sold the script for like The Visit, which did pretty well. Then he had that Devil movie that he wrote that everyone really liked. And then Split.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. You know, Split, where he really, and I got very excited when I saw Split because, oh my God, Unbreakable. We got this trilogy. We're bringing Mr. Glass back. And then he shit the bed. He shit the bed with Glass. What do you think is this dude's deal? Why did he... Because I've read a bunch of interviews and he's clearly he believes in a personal code of just relentless optimism and believing that the universe gives you what you put into it. So like he very rarely is just like, yeah, I suck. I mean, he gave this one commencement speech, which is essentially a little bit like that. Like, yeah, I suck. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm disappointing myself.
I mean, that's just being an artist. Like, but
he's remarkably free from this kind of things. And then, you know, like, what happened to him? My theory is he felt like he had to just keep topping himself in these twists. And that's just hard to do. It's really hard to do without having an occasional miss. And he felt, I felt like in a lot of interviews, he started to feel pigeonholed. Like he never thought he wanted to be like the Stephen King master, Hitchcock, master of suspense horror. He had other stories he wanted to tell. And every time he tried to get in that lane, people hated it. And he was kind of like pissed about it. And now I guess he feels like, you know, like if I had I read this interview where he's like, it feels silly that I ever felt like if I got to make great thrillers the rest of my life, that would be like some kind of failure.
Yeah, I mean, it's a victim of his own success sort of thing. Like, yeah. The Sixth Sense is so good and so talked about and so successful that that's just now who he is to everyone. And yeah. If he tries to do something else, people are automatically going to side eye it. Yeah, I mean, in some ways you feel for him there, but in other ways you're like, well, this is like a second time screenwriter with a bomb under his belt selling a $3 million mm-hmm. option. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
Like he's set for life off this one screenplay. If he never works again, yeah, he might be sad, but I don't know, man.
He wants to. Like a lot of the last few movies clearly. He's done has been self-financed. Like he, like, you know, went into debt, you know, yeah. Mortgaged his home to make Split. And that kind of paid off for him. And then Glass. So I don't know. His first three films are, I think, unimpeachable. Like you can really start to pick holes with Signs because like there is like not necessarily plot holes, but it's much more works on a like a moral morality tale or a fable kind of level than it does like as a just a strict sci-fi horror film.
I thought that felt a little more like Hollywood type of movie.
Yeah,
like it was leaning from like these low budget. Well, not even low budget, honestly, just like these indie vibes into the more Hollywood type of grandeur.
And it was still grounded about that in the characters. Yeah. And the family, you know, you got this family and this guy is priest who lost his wife and it sent him into tailspin and his brother kind of moved in with them. Like that stuff, all the relationship between the brothers, the relationship between the dad and the kids, all that stuff works really well. And I think these, like I said, his first three movies are as far as personal trilogies go, right up there.
Sure.
And I just feel like, yeah, that the weight of expectations, like I just think see him in a pitch room. He's like, he's just telling the story. Well, when's the twist coming in, Knight? And he's like, okay, well, yeah, I guess it can actually be. I don't know. I don't. It's very hard for me to understand how like the Last Airbender happened, though. Like, maybe he just has no business with big blockbuster Hollywood budget stuff. He tried to do that on the cheap with Glass, and honestly, that's where Glass started falling apart. Like, it needed some big kind of Avengers level thing at the end, and he just. I don't think he has the, doesn't have that particular talent, nor did he have the budget to pull it off.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if he feels pigeonholed in low budget psychological thrillers, then, and that's the thing that he's really, really good at, what are you going to do?
There's just one more thing I want to talk about, and it's the end of this movie, the twist, where you find out that Bruce Willis has been dead the whole time. I remembered that being a lot more concrete of a statement without all the flashbacks, because you almost don't have to go back and watch this movie a second time to see if it all hangs together, because they show you, nah, it all hangs together. Like, here's a flashback.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, like, here's not just one flashback. Here's eight of them.
Look at all these.
We're also going to go back and put new footage with him getting
shot. You flew through. Yeah. Fuck you guys.
We're going to put it all on the screen here for you at the end. I thought I remembered it being more concrete than she's cradling a ring that rolls out from under a couch, and that's the mind blowing moment. But you know, I vividly remember the feeling of having my mind blown. When I watch,
that's
this
the
movie.
Thing is that moment holds up. Like you need like 30 seconds of flashbacks to be like, what? Oh God. Oh, it's kind of a massive flex. The movie's just like, look at all the things that you missed in context. And it's like, not even a refilm, like just straight up as clips of like, yeah, her pulling the bill and him wrestling with the, yeah. I wondered it when it was coming, whether that would feel a little indulgent, because they really lay it on thick. Like they have Haley Joel coming in there. I see dead people. They don't even know they're dead. They just see what they want to see. But I don't know. It still worked. Like it didn't feel indulgent because it's such a great moment. And the buildup is so well done that you're like, yeah, movie, take a victory lap. take 30, take 60 seconds if you need it. Bask in this, yeah. You know?
And I like how they mix the flashbacks in with new footage, right? So we get more of the story. We see the, oh, no, there's actually a table in front of the door. Oh, no, he actually died after this gunshot.
There's the bullet hole, and it's like, why isn't he bleeding? Oh, because he fell on his back, and he's massively bleeding on his back.
Right.
And I think the other reason it works is because Bruce Willis, the character, is figuring out that he's dead at the exact same. So like you're also on his, he's reeling that like, oh my God, I'm dead. Oh my God. My wife doesn't love me anymore. She's trying desperately not to, or something like that. Like all that stuff. Like, yeah, it's not just a movie being like, haha, how clever we are. It's also, hey, give Bruce a little chance to process this shit too.
Yeah.
It just really works really well.
It does.
Is that all we got?
That's it.
I do want to encourage people, if you liked our discussion here, we did a Stereo.com show after our science fiction Sunday show, where we talked a little bit about M. Night's career and we opened up the lines to the audience. We're going to be doing these Stereo.com after shows for our Walking Dead coverage. Speaking of horror, we're starting up season 10 this week. Every Wednesday night at 9 o'clock, we're going to be doing a brief, like 30-minute probably after show, where we talk a little bit about the episode and we invite people to come on and use the Stereo.com interface to leave us live messages. You can leave feedback in your own voice right from your cell phone. If you go to Stereo.com/baldmove, you can download the app there and you can follow along, because again, for the next several weeks, every Wednesday at 9 p.m., we're going to be doing that. And that's going to become our feedback show, essentially, for The Walking Dead. So we're going to be doing that. We're pretty excited about. And as a preview, we're going to be dumping in this feed our discussion about M. Night Shyamalan's career and our after discussion of Signs. So check that out if you want some more content. Otherwise, thanks very much for being on this prestigious journey with us through a 22-year-old movie that we really enjoyed. We'll be back in the weeks to come with more prestige films in the prestige slot, because we've got plenty of pulp with The Walking Dead, but we're not sure what's going to be the next prestige show, and we're going to keep doing classic movies until we figure it out. Again, thanks for your support, and we'll see you on the next one.